Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So let's talk about our perpetrator, Sheila LaBarre. So she was born on the 4th of July, 1958. She was born in Alabama, and she was born to her parents, Ruby and Manuel Bailey. She also had 5 siblings, 2 sisters and 3 brothers. She was the baby of the family. I believe that her father used to refer to her as a firecracker. So obviously from an early age, she has some gumption in her personality. They actually, as a family, lived in a small town called Fort Payne. And Ruby, the mum, she worked as a housekeeper, and Manuel was an equipment operator for the State Highway Department. Her home life was challenging. I've heard interviews from her sister who talk about there being an abusive element. And I've heard interviews where our perpetrator in this case is already describing the tumultuous experience that she endured as a child. Her father had problems with alcohol. He was a real problem alcoholic. And when he did drink heavily, he would often become violent. He was violent at other times without having any alcohol, but certainly the alcohol amplified his behavior. And that tended to be more around the weekends when he wasn't working. So it wasn't as if they were going through the week and looking forward to a family orientated time together at the weekend. They were dreading it because terrible things could happen. Now, when LaBarre was 6 years old, her father had a really, really violent episode. And during that episode, he actually turned over appliances in the kitchen. He was shouting, he was screaming, he was raging, he was threatening. He chased his family out of the house. They actually all fled into a cornfield because they were terrified for their lives. And as they were escaping, he actually threw a can of antifreeze at LaBarre, and it left a permanent scar on her finger. So obviously, these are very violent incidences. Her sister, Lynn, who's been interviewed quite a few times, she said that LaBarre had genuinely had a horrible time at the hands of her father and had also been sexually abused by their father. And also, father had let his friends sexually abuse her, at least on another 2 occasions that she was aware of. And ultimately, the fact that she's aware of those times means that it's going to have been more frequent. If you were aware of a few times of abuse playing out, then the likelihood is there will be many times that that abuse is played out. You just won't have been aware of it. LaBarre refers to her father in a very conflictual way. So she says things like, daddy could be very good, but he could also be extremely cruel. And she also noted that her father to her seemed like 2 people. Now that's an interesting descriptor, because if you consider being a child growing up with an abusive parent, and every child wants to grow up believing that they are cared for and loved by their primary caregivers. And if the primary caregiver is sometimes nice, then you want to believe the best in them. It's as simple as that. They can be really abusive. They can be really violent. They can be sexually horrible to you throughout your years as a child growing up. But if they can also be nice to you, it's amazing how your brain can have the ability to compartmentalize those experiences so you can still love your parent. You can see the way that they fail, but you put that in a cruel daddy box and you put the good stuff in a kind daddy box. And that's why it's so challenging for children who are sexually molested, who are physically aggressed, because often they also have this really loving relationship with their parent at times. And any kind of betrayal to them, such as asking for their own needs to be met, going and seeking help, that feels like a disloyalty that is too difficult to bear. And that's why children often stay in the most horrendous of situations, because they genuinely buy into the part of that parent who loves them and who they love in return. And she also said that her mother was very distant, that she didn't feel really any love from her, and at times she also didn't feel loved by either of her parents. Now, LaBarre had big dreams. She came from a small place, but her mind was not tempered by that. She wanted to be a model. She was very beautiful as she was growing up. She also thought about being a country music singer. She basically just wanted to be rich. She wanted to be famous. She wanted to be revered to some degree, because she needed to leave that small town where her family lived to just create a new life where potentially she was living dreams. And she knew that she couldn't achieve that where she was living, but it also meant that she'd be freeing herself from a scenario that had come to plague her, which was the truth about her family background. Now, LaBarre was apparently somebody who could behave in a way that was very empathetic. Apparently, she would be very polite, she'd be very gentle. But others say, you know what, that felt very often inauthentic. It was like a carefully curated, constructed self. It felt like an act. And if you spent enough time with LaBarre in her company, the personality that actually lay beneath that mask would come forward. She was described by people who were close to her as being highly manipulative, very cruel, incredibly volatile, and also very domineering. So you never quite knew who you were going to meet because she could explode. Also, I would say one of the things that she learned very early on was how she could use her body inappropriately. Understandably, when you were a child and you have been molested, your innocence has been affected, your naivety has been taken, and your lines where boundaries are concerned have become blurred because the very people who are meant to protect you and care for you and keep you safe, they failed you. And in her case, her primary caregiver was molesting her and allowing other men to do the same. So understandably, she probably was put in situations where she was given sweets or potentially money during those experiences, because this is what predators do. They make the child feel complicit in the abuse, and that makes the child feel so conflicted, they don't break the loyalty to the perpetrator who's abusing them. But that also can mean that early on, you realize that your body can be a currency. And when you don't have the understanding of why you act this way because you've been damaged and it's not your fault and you've done nothing wrong, and the problem is that resolving all of that can take years, sometimes decades. So a lot of children who have been horribly molested, they start seeing their body as a way to get them to certain places and to get them into certain situations. And that's because they have been taught all these horrible lessons by these horrendous abusers. And that's very psychologically destructive for the child, because as they get older, and they start realizing that actually what's happened is they've just been used and abused, that compounds the damage that's already existing. But this is what she uses her body for. She gets men to be interested in her, and she uses that in a seductive way to essentially get her to wherever she needs to go. And also, the police who actually dealt with her throughout her whole life, they said, listen, we didn't even want to be around her by ourselves. We didn't feel comfortable responding to her by ourselves at all.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
We would always respond to her in pairs. So there is therefore this provocative nature and this idea that if they come to her by herself, something inappropriate might have happened and they could get into serious trouble if an allegation's made. And it's also pretty awkward if somebody is kind of putting themselves on a plate for you when you don't want that. So that's essentially the behaviour that she's emanating as a young woman. We get to 1980. This is when Sheila's 23 years of age and she marries John Baxter. She gets married to him on New Year's Eve. He's only 19 at the time. And we all kind of assume that a 19-year-old guy and a 23-year-old girl is going to mean that there is an absolute dominance emotionally by the 23-year-old girl, because a 19-year-old guy is not going to be as emotionally awake as somebody who is 4 years older than him, who's female. But that is not something that she's concerned about. I think she genuinely wanted to look at creating a new life for herself. That was what was paramount to her. He had already been married to another woman before he actually married LaBarre, which is a little bit concerning at 19. I mean, you're going through them. If you're 19 and you're on your second marriage, he'd had a daughter, Wendy, from that relationship. But just like his first marriage, his second relationship with LaBarre didn't exactly work out very well. In fact, how can I say this? It ran its course incredibly quickly. And the reason for this, it's believed that when John went out of the house, LaBarre was horrible to his daughter. She treated Wendy really terribly. So according to reports, she would shut her in a closet. She'd give her NyQuil to keep her quiet. That's a drug that you'd be given for colds. It's got an antihistamine in it as well, so it can make you really drowsy. John was unbelievably furious when he found out about that, and he ended their relationship after just 6 weeks. So John may have been young and he may have been a bit stupid and impetuous where relationships are concerned, but clearly he is a very good dad. Because anybody who immediately puts that child before the partner, in my eyes, is doing the absolute correct thing. But understandably, for LaBar, that's going to be a rejection. And that also has the power to make her feel like in relationships with men, she is not considered the be-all and end-all, the most important person in their world. And I think that that is something that is really powerfully important to LaBar on a conscious or unconscious level, because she feels like her father has failed her and is therefore looking for a man to be perfect. If you have had a fractured relationship with a primary caregiver, in this case a father, and you feel that to really have value, you have to find somebody who loves you in totality. Often you will hold men that come into your world to a degree that they cannot achieve, because ultimately you are constantly trying to create a fix for the fractures that occurred in childhood. And that means that over time, the men will fail again and again and again, thus reinforcing actually the experience of being a child, which is that you've been abandoned and you've been abused. And also meaning that because you're the one setting these unrealistic standards, that even great people who walk into your life could never succeed where your relationship is concerned, because you just decide they have to be this perfect example of a human being and no one is. Now, that same year, LaBar meets Ronnie Jennings. And the reason for this is she started to work at a restaurant after she separates from John, and Ronnie works there too. So they begin dating, and apparently LaBar falls head over heels in love with him really quickly. Now, Ronnie initially really wasn't into the idea of getting married. They're young, she's just out of a relationship, but she was very persistent. She wore him down and wore him down, and in the end, he just agrees to get married. But it's pretty immediate after they get married that the relationship is problematic. LaBar actually cried on her wedding day and said that it had been a mistake. They were arguing frequently, and Ronnie said that one of the things that was really problematic was that her mood swings were so aggressive, they'd often turn physical. There was one particular argument where LaBar was so distressed after one of these very, very aggressive interactions between the two. She decided she didn't want to be here anymore and she tried to take her own life, and she really did. This was an attempt that could really have been effective in ending her life. She actually took loads of sedative tablets. Then she started driving in a car and she actually had a car accident. Now, she survived, but she was in a coma for around a week. And when she was in the situation, in the car, she actually talks about that experience of feeling like she was entering a different universe, a different paradigm. And I think that she almost believed that she was entering heaven. And then, of course, she comes back to this world when actually she gets out of the coma. She's then put into a psychiatric facility. But once she's discharged, she said that she was having all these visions when she'd been in hospital, and she feels that she'd been sent back to Earth as an avenging angel. This was somebody who was going to be on a mission from God to eliminate paedophiles from the world. Also, while she was in hospital, she told her sister that a member of staff had actually tried to rape her, which would have been a horrendous thing if that had actually happened. I do have to say that I think LaBar is not the most trustworthy person, but I do think it's really important to just take a moment to explore what she had been through. She's taken a hell of a lot of sedatives. She's got into a car. She's had a serious crash. She's been in a coma for a week. The brain has certainly suffered some kind of injury in that experience. On top of that, she's had these very powerful visions, as far as she's concerned, where all of a sudden she's been gifted with this purpose to avenge the people out there who are harming children. Now, when you just think about her background, the violence that she experienced with her father, the sexual abuse that she experienced with her father, the being lent out to other men by her father, you can imagine the conflict that she experiences just psychologically from that trauma. Then she has this, let's call it an NDE, a near-death experience, where she believes she has seen ultimately a different level to our experience as human, potentially somewhere between here and the afterlife. And now she has this intense purpose, which is to rid the world of these terrible men who hurt children, and also that she is an avenging angel. She is somebody who has this power. So she now isn't just somebody who can protect the child that she used to be. She's somebody who can avenge the child that once was. And even though we know that's delusionary, you can kind of make sense of how that will play out in that potential delusion in her mind. Now, her marriage to Ronnie ends with him describing her as unbalanced. He just couldn't cope with the way that she was on a mood level. And Ronnie's mother said that LaBar was a really mean person. And one of the things that really concerned her was that she genuinely thought that if he stayed with LaBar, he might end up dead, which is something that's rather a premonition when we're talking about this case. Get to 1987. Things haven't been working well for LaBar. It's as simple as that. We know that she's wanted to leave where she is. We know that she wants to have money, the trappings of fame, an opportunity to stand out, and none of that's occurred. In fact, all she's had is failure in relationships. She sees a Lonely Hearts advert. This is placed by a man who she's going to take the name of, a man called Wilfred LaBar. He's 61 years of age at the time. Recently, he's experienced the loss of his wife. He doesn't like being alone. And he wants to spend time with somebody because he doesn't want that loneliness to manifest anymore. And the ad actually read, "Doctor, widower, looking for someone not too tall." He was a chiropractor. He actually owned a 150-acre horse farm in Epping. Had loads of land. It was remote. And that probably appealed to LaBar with respect. Now, the way that she decides to entice him, because at the end of the day, you would imagine a guy who's saying, "I'm a bit lonely, I'm looking for somebody to share nice times with," basically is looking for an emotional component. But LaBar's like, "Well, I could go down that route. I could get in contact with him and suggest we meet up for a coffee and discuss our interests." But she kind of thinks, "Well, we could do that, but why not be more direct? I'll just send him a topless photo of myself." I mean, genuinely, I understand what her mindset is there. She's just thinking, this guy, he's older, he's lost his wife. He's going to see a picture of a topless, attractive 28-year-old. Chances are he's going to be like, "Ooh, that's a little bit outside of what I expected to receive. Maybe I will actually meet her." And that's exactly what happens. So she sends this topless photo of herself in response to the ad saying, "I'm 28, 5'5", and weigh 117 pounds. I do not smoke, have a great sense of humour, and I love life. Judge a person from the inside, the mind and heart." Sorry, I'm just not buying that, Miss LaBar. At the end of the day, you can't say, "I judge a person from the inside, mind and heart." You don't, because you sent him a picture of your boobs. So what you think is going to attract him is not your mind and your heart. It's the two things that are protruding on your chest. Anyway, they get together, he's very enamoured by her, and she ends up moving to his farm. Obviously, a topless photo is deeply emotional and connecting and doesn't speak of something based purely on physical form. But hey, who am I to judge? So LaBar at this point is clearly a very beautiful woman. She's much younger than Wilfred, who's a widower. I think he'd have been thrilled that she was interested in him. And he probably knows that his world that he's created with the financial security and the farm he's got is going to be really interesting to her because it gives her a secure foundation financially. So they're both kind of getting what they want from it. Now, after she develops a relationship with Wilfred, she basically decides that she's his common law wife. That's why she ends up being called LaBar. They were never actually married with respect. She also immediately wheedles her way in to get power of attorney. And then she starts to exert control over his workplace. So Wilfred has this chiropractic clinic and she starts increasing prices. She starts firing staff who don't submit to everything she wants. She also talked down the line about her and Wilfred's relationship. She said that they didn't have a conventional relationship. But what I actually think she meant was, I'm a massive cheater and he's too old to argue with me and I'm pretty domineering, so I just get away with whatever I want. Because if you actually listen to what went on in their relationship, it's very odd. Apparently he didn't have any problem with her sleeping with other men, which she often did. And she also said that their relationship like that was normal to them and they didn't do anything to hurt each other. I mean, I think that's a stretch, isn't it? We didn't do anything to hurt each other. I don't think Wilfred did anything to hurt you, that's right. But I'm pretty sure you sleeping with all and sundry probably wasn't what he was going for when he put that advert in the classifieds. But this is what she does. And what are you hearing there? It's a very egocentric perspective. It's a woman who cares about her own needs ultimately and will do whatever she wishes and no one will control her. Again, that could be a reaction to her childhood where she said that men controlled her and she no longer wants to feel that way. But it's very unfair on Wilfred. He's paying the bill for everything and she's taking full advantage of exploiting him. Now in 1995, Wayne Ennis ends up meeting Labar through Wilfred's chiropractic clinic. He's a migrant worker. He'd actually moved to America from Jamaica and he actually worked in fields harvesting crops. So he came to Wilfred because he'd been injured in a car accident the previous year and Labar instantly took an interest in Wayne. She starts flirting with him. Let's say this interest was reciprocated. She ends up marrying Wayne in August of that year. I kid you not, she marries Wayne whilst apparently being in a relationship with her common law husband, Wilfred Labar, and they're all living at the farm together. And also Wayne is working on the farm. So they live as a threesome to some degree, even though obviously there's nothing sexual between Wayne and Wilfred. They have this nonetheless strange relationship where all three of them have this situation and arrangement, which apparently works for them. Wilfred apparently gets on very well with Wayne, pays him for doing some work on the farm, but it's very, very questionable as to whether Wilfred would have been at peace with what Labar was doing, because ultimately he's being disrespected in a huge way. Now, Wayne, who's now married Labar, he later described Wilfred as genuinely being like a father to him. He was somebody who was really kind, really attentive and really caring, in spite of the fact that Wayne is now sleeping with Labar. Utterly bizarre. Now, none of you will be surprised when I tell you that Labar really quickly becomes abusive towards Wayne and she's threatening to kill him. She's saying that she's going to send him back to Jamaica in a box. She shoots a gun over his head, which could have killed him. Also, she'd kick him out. This is when it was freezing. He'd be made to sleep on the floor in these horrendous conditions. And another thing that she would do, which would have been terrifying as far as Wayne was concerned, is she would cut herself or hurt herself. And then she'd actually threaten to call the police and say that she was going to blame him for the injuries. And we all understand that that's rare when women do those things or when men do those things. But when you are put in a position where somebody is saying, look, I've hurt myself and now I'm going to blame you, particularly when you're a man, and it's a woman who's the complainant, understandably because of domestic violence being a...
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Feel experience for many women, if the police arrive, it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to get them believing what she's saying. And then she takes matters even further and it starts to deeply concern Wayne because she starts saying, I want Wilfred dead. She says that she wants a horse to kick Wilfred in the head and kill him. She also tells Wayne that she'd even thought about strangling him herself. And then she says to Wayne, I'd actually like you to kill Wilfred for me. Now, I don't know about you, but I shall just throw it out there to the masses. If I was with somebody and I turned to them and I said, oh, I'm really annoyed with my sister. I would like you to kill my sister. And that person went, yeah, how do you want me to do it? The truth is, you need to back away because that person's very dangerous. It is not a typical response for anybody to be like, how would you like me to get rid of them? And to be fair, Wayne isn't one of those people, quite the contrary. Now, he's not a murderer as a human being. It's not within him to do that anyway. But also, he really likes Wilfred. Wilfred has been super kind to him. He loves the fact that he's been allowed to work for Wilfrid Labar, and also that he's been treated with absolute compassion by this man, in spite of the fact that he ends up sleeping with the woman that this man thought he was in a relationship with. But hey, whatever works. But he's not got any motivation, essentially, for killing anyone. Now, he later wrote in a letter, "I hesitate, I can't do that, I am not a murderer." He was really scared to say no to her, and she was not happy to be turned down by him. But essentially, he knew his moral compass, but he does start to get scared. He thinks to himself, listen, she's asking me to kill Wilfrid, a guy who's been really nice to her, a guy that's been really nice to me. And she gets angry with me. She fires a gun above my head. So understandably, he starts thinking, maybe she will kill me. Now, the couple end up divorcing in December 1996. He's got all these worries and concerns anyway, but then Wayne reportedly walks in on Labar, cheating on him with a man called Jimmy Brackett. So that essentially is the final nail in the coffin, shall we say. And I'm sure on reflection, Wayne considers that he's a very, very lucky person who's had a very, very lucky escape, because believe me, he really did. So let's talk about Jimmy Brackett. Well, he was called James Brackett, but everybody knew him as Jimmy. She begins to date him while she's still married to Wayne. We get that. This is her MO. He's working around the farm. He's looking after the horses. He's maintaining the farm, essentially. And then in 1996, he ends up moving in with her when the relationship with Wayne comes to an end. Poor Wilfrid. That's all I can say at this moment in time. This woman is just moving guys in to his farm. I cannot imagine where Wilfrid's head was. I imagine he must have been scared, or maybe there was an ambivalence there. Maybe he'd moved into a position where he was treating her more like she was just some kind of person staying and renting, or maybe he had some kind of inclination that she was more of a daughter figure. But she is just running ragged over this guy. Now, there were instances where Labar became very violent with Jimmy. She'd do things like scratch his face. Again, like she did with Wayne, she'd be firing bullets near him as a threat. She'd once actually knocked his front tooth out with a wooden stick. In one instance, she chased him with an axe. There was another incident in 1998. This led to a second degree assault charge because she stabbed him in the head with a pair of scissors. And he did actually need to go to hospital for treatment. Now, the charges were dropped, but we all know how that works. It will just be that he has said that it didn't happen and he didn't want to press charges, he wasn't going to give him any evidence, etc. But she is high-level aggressing this guy. And it also speaks of why so often men find themselves in these dangerous situations, because they cannot compute that a woman is this capable. And so they stay because they think, oh, it will just be this occasion that this person has done it. They won't ever do it again. And then the next minute, they've got a pair of scissors sticking out of the brain. Now, she actually told him that she had suspicions that he was abusing animals on the farm, and also that she believes that he's a paedophile. Remember what we've been told about her initially when she went into that psychiatric unit after the crash? She's come back, as far as she's concerned, as this avenging angel, and now she's accusing a guy that she's actually with as a paedophile. Now, with respect, that can also legitimise her violence. Also, she tells him that she thinks he's a paedophile. Now, that was simply not true. But at the end of the day, if she wants to legitimise her violence, bearing in mind what we already know about her being in the psychiatric unit and believing that she's come back as some kind of avenging angel, well, acting as if this person that you're being horrendous to is a paedophile just allows you a permission base to be horrendous to them and violent to them, because essentially that's what you're here to do. Now, he later said that he ended up just confessing to the accusations because Sheila Labar was absolutely hysterical on one occasion. And if he hadn't have actually said, okay, you're right, he believes that she would have killed him. And I actually think that he's correct. I think that she needed to hear that she was 100% correct to validate her feelings. And even though that was meant to make her even more angry, because there again, she's meant to be this avenging angel, in that moment, it calmed her because she was right. And it was the ego that was being stroked. I knew I was right. This guy is an animal abuser and is a pedophile. We get to December 2000. And then really sadly at this point, Wilfrid dies from a heart attack. He's 74 years old at the time. My goodness. He has put up with her for years, and she ends up inheriting everything. She gets his horse farm. He had children, and Wilfrid's children argue against the will, but they're unsuccessful. Very often these cases are unsuccessful. If somebody was seen to be in sound mind when they write a will, no matter how much somebody is coercing them, that will often stand up in court because nobody saw what was going on behind closed doors, and she could well have forced him to write a will. He could have been so scared of her, and ultimately she could have made him feel he had to be in a position to actually go ahead and sign everything over to her. But when a judge sees it, the reality is this: there's a will and a testament that has been done in sound mind, and it says that she's getting everything. So she does. Now, there is actually quite a lot of speculation around his death. Some people genuinely think that LaBar contributed to it in some way, and it would not surprise me. She was telling Wayne she wanted to kill him. His body was sadly cremated really quickly after his death. And that same year, LaBar's father and also one of her brothers died. So there was a lot of loss, whether she was at the centre of it in certain cases or otherwise, that particular year. We get to 2002, and then Jimmy, who she's in a relationship with, eventually manages, I'm going to use this word correctly because this is what happens, to escape the farm. He needs to escape. He is terrified. He actually left one day during a snowstorm and he went straight away to seek refuge in a homeless shelter. He would rather be in a homeless shelter than in that place with her. She was so scary. He was absolutely determined to get away from her at that point. He felt as if his life had been completely controlled for the whole period of the relationship that he shared with her. And I'm surprised it took him so long, because genuinely being in her company at this point was toxic beyond measure and dangerous beyond measure. And he really does consider himself to be lucky to be alive. In fact, his number plate on his car reads, "I'm alive." I mean, that's a strong reaction, you know? That's a strong reaction. I'm going to remind myself every time I get into my car that I am still breathing. And I'm still breathing because I left LaBar, genuinely. We get to 2004. She's back to her usual routine. She's looking for a man and she meets one, a guy called Michael Deloge. He had developmental disabilities. So he was already described by people when they meet as being down on his luck. He's living in a homeless shelter. His previous relationship has ended and his former partner has basically cut off all contact with him. So he's grieving. The couple had had a son together, and that was something that really laid heavy on his mind. He really found the separation very upsetting. It was very complicated for him. He was self-medicating with drugs. He was drinking. And he was relatively unknown to the people in the local town. It wasn't as if he stood out. People weren't aware of him. So when he ends up moving to LaBar's farm, it's not as if people are really following that journey. But at this point, he starts doing work for LaBar. And that must have been very appealing for Michael because, first of all, homeless shelters are really hard to actually live in. They're loud. Sometimes you can have a lot of conflict in them. If you are a dependent, there's always access to alcohol and drugs, and it can be really, really challenging. Getting out of a homeless shelter and then going to go and live on a farm must have felt like an absolute bolt from the blue and an opportunity of a lifetime. The peace, the tranquility, the space, the homeliness. Again, it doesn't take long, and she has got him in her bed as well as working on the farm. Now, at this point, Michael had a really good relationship with his mother and also his stepfather. They end up meeting LaBar on a few occasions. His stepfather said that he initially understood why Michael liked LaBar. She was actually fun. She was attractive. But his parents really didn't like the fact that they were intimately together. Also, LaBar was really over-the-top jealous when Michael spent time with his mum. And if Michael hugged his mother, which is completely typical, LaBar would get really angry. Now, I suppose that that reaction could be for many reasons. So she might not be able to separate a primary caregiver with sexual contact because she sees her father and her relationship as representative as everyone's. Therefore, when she looks at Michael hugging his mother, she sees that sexually and it really aggresses her nature. It could be that she hates the idea of Michael having a good relationship with a primary caregiver who actually loves him, because that's something that she herself was denied. Whatever is provoking the rage provokes it to a point where it's deeply problematic and fractures their relationship. Always, LaBar wants to be the centre of attention. always, LaBar wants Michael to do exactly what she tells him, and she just orders him around consistently. One time, this is on LaBar's encouragement as well, Michael ends up telling his mother that he's starting to remember things about the past. So she's now, by the way, implanting memories for Michael. So Michael's saying to his mum, you've really messed me up. You've abused me as a child. He then says, I don't want any more contact with you at all. This is so coercive. This is so toxic. This is so corrosive. And yet this is something that LaBar is very, very good at. His mother's devastated. She can't believe these allegations, they're all untrue. She can't believe that he is being coerced by LaBar. And she can't believe that ultimately it is breaking the relationship that she has with her son. In fact, she last saw her son in 2005. So it's devastating. Now, numerous people witnessed LaBar's abuse of Michael. This includes neighbours. It includes people who came and worked on the farm. One farm worker actually said that Michael would be beaten up so badly, but he would never hit LaBar back. Another said that Michael would be beaten senselessly, literally to the point where, as far as they were concerned looking on, they believe he would have had internal injuries as a result. They saw LaBar punch, kick, throw and knock him down. One witness saw Michael staggering down a road in the middle of a blizzard. He was bleeding from his head. And they obviously questioned him about this because he looked really damaged. And they said, what's happened? He just said, Sheila LaBar. Now, Michael suddenly vanishes, disappears. This is at some point in 2005 and no one knows where he's gone. We then get to 2006. At this point, Sheila meets Kenneth County. Now, he went by the name Kenny and she met him through a sex chat line called Telemates. Again, there is something vulnerable about Kenny. He's got autism, he's got a mild intellectual disability, and he's 24 years of age. So he's a lot younger than her. He also has a mental capacity of a 12-year-old. Now, at the time that they meet, he's got a job at a local car wash, but he had tried previously to actually enlist in the army. He hadn't been able to graduate, and he was devastated by this. That was his dream, to join the army. So he'd been crushed by this point. He'd actually tried to take his own life. Fortunately, at that point, his attempt failed. So what have we got here? Another absolutely vulnerable man that Sheila LaBar has set her sights on. Now, the pair arranged to meet on Valentine's Day at the Ashworth by the Sea Hotel in Hampton. They end up romantically having sex in Kenny's car. I mean, if that isn't what you want to do on a Valentine's Day in a car park, I don't know what you're doing with your Valentine's Days, with respect. Now, the relationship very quickly moves from there. So going back to what people have said about her, using her body as a way to intensely connect with a man very quickly, it's effective for her. It's a good MO as far as she is concerned. So Kenny at this point moves to Epping, lives on the farm with Sheila LaBar, tells...
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
His brother Brian, he's got a girlfriend who's rich, and I bet that's what he felt, because if somebody's got 150 acres and a farm and you're not having to pay rent in that moment, it is going to feel like you've really hit the jackpot. He also says that they're in love. Brian's really suspicious. At the end of the day, he's got this young brother who's literally just a young adult, and Sheila LaBar is 47 at this point. Now, as she had done with Wilfred and with Michael, Sheila really quickly isolates Kenny from his family and friends. He stops working at the car wash. Also, he abruptly and without any real notice moves out of his apartment. This is one that he shares with a friend. He actually stops talking to that former flatmate because he says he can't go back there because his flatmate's apparently been rude to LaBar. But again, isn't she doing an effective job? She isolates these individuals. She cuts off their connections and their relationships. And then there is nothing that they can do because they have nowhere to go. They're financially dependent on her and she is controlling every move they make. Another thing that was deeply worrying for the family is he stopped calling his mum, and he'd called his mum every single day before he met Sheila LaBarre. So then we get to 2006, it's February the 24th. Kenny's mum, Carolyn, she's really getting worried about her son. They'd been very close from the get-go, and now he isn't even returning her calls, so let alone he doesn't call her, no calls are actually being answered. So she goes ahead, she files a missing persons report, and she files that both in the area where she lives, as well as in Epping, where LaBarre's farm's located. Bear in mind, LaBarre is known to the police. She is a contrary stroke objectionable human being every day of the week. So the police know who she is. Now, Sergeant Sean Gallagher, that was the person who took the call from Carolyn, he actually had to respond to reports many times. So he personally had gone out and dealt with Sheila around 24 times since 1995. Literally, I am at an age where I am considered definitely middle-aged. And in my entire experience, the police have never come out to see me because of objectionable behaviour. At the end of the day, it takes a very strange person to end up having lots and lots of call-outs by the police. And also, what does it say about their psychology, about their mindset, about the kind of impulse control that they have, their poor boundaries? To repeatedly have the police called out to deal with you means that there is something really wrong about your behaviour. So, of course, the police have to act and they go and do a welfare check on Kenny that very day. They get to the farm. Initially, LaBarre basically says Kenny isn't there. She just denies him being there, full stop. Then she actually says, okay, he is here, but he was actually in the bath and you're not going to talk to him. They're not happy with this. They're there to do a welfare check. And if anything is going on that's untoward, they need to know. Kenny eventually comes to the door. Now, at that point, he looked well. He's got no shirt on. The police thought that he looked to be in good health. There was nothing obviously problematic about his body. So they're in a sticky situation. He's there of his own free will. So essentially, the police officers leave the farm. Apparently, Sheila LaBarre was very eager for them to do so. Kenny was living as an independent adult at this point, so there was nothing else the police could do. Now, after the police visit the farm, LaBarre actually sends a fax, which was signed by Kenny saying he was safe, he was sane, and he was very happy. It's very manipulative to do that, isn't it? At the end of the day, if the police come out to do a welfare check, you just accept that somebody's reported that person as potentially missing. You alleviate the fears of the police and you move on. The idea that she then gets him to fax saying that he is safe, sane, and very happy, it's over the top. It speaks of something going on beneath the surface that is probably quite sinister. And I imagine that the police connected with that in that moment. A couple of days after the visit, LaBarre literally calls the police in an agitated state. At that point, she's saying to them, I'm going to sue you if you come onto my property in the future, which is ludicrous because if they have reasonable grounds to come onto her property, they're going to do that. But there's obviously, again, something going on in her mind that's making her feel this aggression towards the police. We get to March the 17th, 2006. So this is very recent to them actually going around, less than a month. And the police are called to the Walmart in Epping. Why? Because somebody is acting disruptively and somebody is causing a scene. And guess who that is? Well, Sergeant Gallagher is going to find out yet again. And he wasn't surprised. He could see it was LaBarre who was causing the problem. But that wasn't what stood out for him. Because he has seen Kenny before on that welfare check. And boy, things have changed because the physical state of Kenny is horrific. He had rapidly declined since they'd done that welfare check less than a month earlier. His skin colour was this ashen colour. He was drooling. He had cuts and bruises on his face and hands. And one of his hands apparently looked like it wasn't even able to function properly. He's also just slumped over in his wheelchair. At this point, LaBarre tells the police officers that Kenny had been in a car accident. This is why he's got these injuries. They then try to address Kenny. LaBarre says, don't speak to the police officers. LaBarre at this point is also trying to buy empty gas containers, which she'd stacked on Kenny in the wheelchair. And as they go to the car, they noted that Kenny seemed really, really weak. He wasn't able to walk properly, needed LaBarre to help him into the vehicle. Now, of course, this is harrowing, isn't it? Because we think to ourselves, well, hang on a minute. This sounds like this young man is in a terrible state and is probably in need of serious medical attention. And there's a part of me that thinks, why weren't the police being very clear? We need to get some help for this young man. And actually, Kenny's mum would say later down the line that they shouldn't have let him leave with Labar. And I agree. I get it's a difficult situation. I get he's a grown adult who can make his own decisions. But he's in a real state. His health has declined massively in less than a month. Essentially, they should have acted in that moment to protect him. I'm not sure how the police felt in that moment. But certainly, if there are reasonable grounds to get medical attention for somebody, even if that person doesn't necessarily show that they're that aware that they require it, I think that that would speak to a mental issue. So either way, his capacity should have been challenged in that moment. Because if you are literally falling apart in a chair and you think you're okay, that shows a lack of capacity. And if you are being controlled by a human being who is around you that is scaring you so you don't feel that you can speak, that is a lack of capacity. And certainly for me, an intervention should have occurred in that moment. But Labar isn't going to leave Sergeant Gallagher alone for very much longer anyway, because on the 22nd of March 2006, she calls him. At this point, she says Kenny's left the farm. She also says that she's really annoyed that she may be referred to as a suspicious person in the report about the incident at the Walmart a few days prior. It seems like she is so egocentric all the time, so paranoid about things. And you can't help but think, well, why was she so paranoid? What was going on behind closed doors that makes her firstly want to tell the police that Kenny is no longer present? And secondly, to take issue and umbrage with the fact that she was noted as a suspicious person at Walmart in the incident before that he'd been involved in, when she was the suspicious person at Walmart. She was. That's why they called the police. But again, she's trying to essentially reduce suspicion, and all she's doing is increasing it. Now, Kenny's mother, Caroline, she goes ahead and she speaks to Sergeant Gallagher. She says that she's been informed that Kenny's left Labar's farm, and that's terrifying for her. It's really worrying. Bear in mind, this young man has a mental age of 12. She said that Kenny had had real problems with mental deficiencies since birth, and that he literally could not be on his own because of that. She said if he'd have left, he would have called someone. He would have called one of us, a member of his family, to help him. Officers at this point need to speak to Labar. They need to figure out where on earth has Kenny gone, because there are real concerns for his safety. On the 24th of March 2006, Labar calls Sergeant Gallagher again. I think at this point, Gallagher is probably feeling like he's living some kind of Labar life. And at this point, she reaffirms that Kenny's left the farm. She also claims, wait for it, that Kenny was a paedophile. Just like with the other man, he's a paedophile too. Who'd have thought that this woman could essentially keep attracting these apparent child abusers? And she validates this by saying she's got an audio recording which will prove it. So she plays the recording over the phone, and that audio contains Labar questioning Kenny about raping children. Now, he's answering those questions in a really weak, muffled voice. And towards the end of the audio clip, it sounds like Kenny's being sick. But Sheila Labar is saying Kenneth County is now faking that he's throwing up, and Kenny can be heard crying in the background. And then the tape actually ends just after Labar says Kenneth County is now faking that he fainted. So what we can hear in that audio is a man who's either very badly injured or very, very sick being coerced and forced into saying things that she wants him to say. So the police officer isn't going, oh my God, we should have known. We should have known Kenny was a wrong gun. He's thinking, what the hell has happened to Kenny? At the end of the day, what is this woman doing recording this and then telling me that he's admitted to this by playing this audio where clearly this guy is saying whatever he needs to say? So the police go over to Labar's farm, again, because they want to check whether Kenny's actually there. She's out when they arrive, but there is a fire lit in a burn barrel in the garden. And the officers are thinking to themselves, what is Sheila Labar burning? Particularly if she might be burning something that is evidence-based. They go over and they have a look around and they think they can see a bone that's burning in the fire. They also at that point feel they've got reasonable grounds to enter Sheila's house. because they've seen what looks to be burning bone when there is a case of a guy going missing, somebody who could have been injured on an audio recording. But just as they're about to, they hear screams coming from the bar. She's in the distance. She's actually been shopping and she's just shouting, "What are you doing?" "Well, we're going to go into your house, Ms. Labar, because we think we've found potentially a dead body in your garden. Try that for a start." Now, Labar does allow the officers to look inside the house. It's a state. It really is. There's filth. There's rotten food in the sink. There's actually rabbits running loose. It smelled really awful and it was just falling apart. She hadn't kept it in a state of repair at all. They also see a pair of shoes, which they 100% know belong to Kenny, but Sheila Labar will not let them take them. She also said, "I've got no idea where Kenny is." But she's then asked, "Well, whose is that bone in the fire?" And she said, "Well, that's a rabbit or a paedophile." Now, she later denies that she actually said that, but it's a very unusual thing for police to relay, isn't it? I mean, it's not a normal statement. Yes, there is a level of incrimination, but it's also something that I can't see a police officer making up. Labar then asks the police to leave and says that they can't take the bone with them. March 25th, the police return. They've got a search warrant this time. At this point, Labar's outside. She's actually kneeling where the fire had been the night before, and she is sifting through the remains. She's covered in ash. And she says to the police, "I knew you were going to come back." And she then asks, "Are you going to arrest me?" The officers ask her about Kenny again. They ask her about his whereabouts. You know, "This is what we're looking for. We're looking to find this young man. Do you know where he is?" There's a very simple answer to that, if she knows where he is. And if she doesn't, we would expect for her to deny it. But instead she says, "He's in that bag." So all of a sudden, she's saying she has cremated this guy after clearly killing him. They look in the bag. And they do indeed see bone fragments. Later, it is confirmed that some of those were human remains. Also, in the septic tank, they find more incriminating things. So items belonging to Michael Deloge, that included his passport, it included a letter to his mother. And they also found evidence that something sinister had occurred inside the farm. They found significant amounts of blood spatter evidence on the walls. Some of those stains were really fresh, others were old. When Labar was interviewed, again, she sticks to this justification theory that Kenny was a paedophile. She said, "He confessed this to me, that he's raped numerous children." Now, none of those claims are substantiated because none of them were true. Sergeant Gallagher said there is no evidence and not even a sliver of an investigation against Kenneth County for ever being a paedophile. But at this point, there was not actually enough evidence to arrest Sheila. Fortunately, by March 31st, 2006, that had changed. There was an arrest warrant issued for her. But she'd fled. She thought, "Oh, bit bang to rights here. Human bones in the garden. Lots of incriminating material about another person who disappeared. Probably need to get some money and do one." So she'd withdrawn a large sum of money from her bank account. She left town, travelled to Boston, dyed her hair. And at this point, she's calling herself Casey. I do love how the minds of criminals work. "I'll just withdraw loads of money. I'll totally change my hair colour and I'll start a new life by giving myself a new name. Nobody will recognise this face that's exactly the same as the face that's on all the wanted posters." At the end of the day, it's obvious when somebody sees an Eva on TV, if you happen to have that same face, even if your hair is very, very different. She ends up reverting to type. She meets a guy very quickly. He recognises her from the news, probably thinks, "Jesus, I have a killer in my home," and calls the police immediately to let them know where she is, thinking, "My God, get here quickly because she might kill me too." We get to April the 2nd, 2006, so clearly she wasn't on the run for very long at all. At this point, she is arrested. Now, the police officers who got involved in her interrogation, they said she came across as deeply cunning, very intelligent, very frightening, and she basically knew all the right things to say. They also said that what was clear was that she wanted to dominate the conversation. She didn't want to be the person being interrogated. She wanted to be leading it. She wanted to take it in the direction that she chose. She didn't like other people having a level of control over her, even in a scenario where ultimately they had absolute control over her. That's the reality. Her actions have caused this, but she's not comfortable with that at all. The trial begins May 2008. LaBarre pleads not guilty, and she pleads not guilty by reason of insanity to the first degree murder of Kenny County. But also at this point, she reveals that she is not guilty by reason of insanity to the murder of Michael Deloge. Now, this is surprising because at this point, she'd only been officially charged for the murder of Kenny. Now, during this confession, she does elaborate on what happened. She confessed to stabbing Kenny and then burning his body. She also admits that she killed Michael and that she burnt his body too, but they didn't actually disclose how she killed him. And his remains have sadly never been recovered, so his family have never been able to put him to rest, essentially, which is awful. LaBarre was described by the defence as being delusional. So they're arguing that basically she doesn't see the world as it really is. The defence argued that she just basically believed that every man was a paedophile, and she considered herself to be this avenging angel who had this special purpose to just rid the world of these paedophiles. And so they're arguing that when she commits the murder, she is insane. But she isn't, is she? And the reason I'm saying she isn't is she was able to absolutely coercively control and violently control these men on a range of levels, get them to do whatever she requested of them, admit to whatever she desired, because ultimately she's a terrifying human being who uses violence and aggression to get what she wants. This is not somebody who is in a psychotic break. She wants to create a narrative in the world, and she goes out of her way to do that effectively by forcing the men to agree with her, even when what she is saying is entirely made up, because it legitimizes the violence she then uses on them. She is a good person, they are a terrible person, and she keeps perpetuating that cycle. Now, the prosecution, they argue very differently. They say, listen, LaBarre is completely sane. She killed Michael and Kenny while she was sane. She was crude, manipulative, cruel, and vindictive. They said that she had a need to control, dominate, and humiliate. Now, the forensic psychologist for the state, Dr. Albert Dratinis, he conducted interviews with Sheila. And what he said was that he felt that her intense anger, her obsession, and the feelings that she had around paedophilia and paranoia are actually signs of a mood disorder and a personality disorder. He said that there wasn't enough evidence to demonstrate that she was driven to commit her crimes by a mental illness. He said that during, and he did 12 hours of interview with her, she answered the questions that he asked very well. And she basically tried to explain away evidence that made her look bad, which is obviously very manipulative. It's not somebody who is losing their mind. It's someone who's calculated. He said that's not what you would see over many hours in a person who is psychotic. Now, during the trial, there were recordings that had been made by LaBarre, and they were played. In fact, there were hundreds of recordings. They lasted over 1,000 hours. During these recordings, she's basically interrogating and shouting at men. Often she's doing the classic that she reverts to where she's saying they're all paedophiles. Some of the men have never actually been identified, but in the tapes which featured Kenny County, he can be heard just agreeing to questions, such as questions where he's told he hates his mother and he agrees, that she abused him as a child and he agrees. Malcolm Rogers, who was a forensic psychologist, he said that while it seems that Sheila believes what she's saying on the tapes to be true, he thought that it sounded like Kenny was simply agreeing to appease her. And that is 100% the case. He was scared. He was just saying whatever he needed to say to hope that it would be over soon. We get to the 13th of May, 2008. At this point, the jury do find Sheila LaBarre to be sane, and therefore they find her guilty of the murders. And for those murders, she was sentenced to 2 life sentences without the possibility of parole, so she will never be free. Sheila LaBarre later appealed her sentence, as we expect. She argued that she hadn't voluntarily consented to the police officers searching her home on the March 24th, which was the day before the warrant was obtained. She had also unsuccessfully attempted to suppress the evidence seized from the search of her home prior to her trial. It gets to 2010 when they were looking at her appeal and they deny it. It was basically determined that the search of Sheila LaBarre's home was justified, both by Sheila providing consent, but also by the police's community caretaking function. They were looking for somebody who'd gone missing and there were bones burning in the garden. That's reasonable grounds to search. Now, because there are over 1,000 hours of taped recordings by LaBar, some with men who they never identified, understandably, many people suspect that there are more unknown victims who were killed by LaBar. She's often referred to as a serial killer because clearly she killed at least two men. There was a cooling off period in between, so that meets the definition. Also, lots of different men stayed at the farm with LaBar at different times. Also, a little bit concerning, they found severed toes at the farm and they didn't belong to the two people that they know are dead. So I think we can all agree it's highly likely that there were other victims and they never actually found the rest of anybody. So they haven't been able to confirm whether she killed or who she killed. But let's all agree, toes usually belong to somebody. That's kind of why toes exist. Now, Kenny's mother, Caroline, she said that her son just wanted to be loved. He saw the good in everyone. He didn't want to hurt anyone and he didn't think that anyone would hurt him. She said that her memory of him is that he was just always smiling. She also said that LaBar could tell from the get-go that he'd got problems and that's why she chose to go after him, because he was going to be the kind of person that she could control. She described LaBar as a master of evil who deliberately tortured Kenny and also stripped him of all his dignity and self-worth. Kenny's family actually sued the Epping Police Department. They said, why on earth did you not intervene when you saw him at the Walmart in this really awful condition? That lawsuit was actually unsuccessful, but I do have complete sympathy and empathy with that family, because if they had have intervened, well, essentially Kenny would likely have been alive, and that must be a cross that is really difficult to carry, because ultimately any parent wants to protect their child, and you think that if a police officer is near them in the moment of need, well, that's going to happen. And in this case, Sheila LaBar was still able to manipulate the law enforcers and to take Kenny away, and ultimately he lost his life in a really heinous scenario. This is one of those cases that I imagine some of you will have some conflict over. When you hear about her childhood, you hear about the molestation, the abuse, the alcoholism of her father, the environment of violence that she was growing up in that's confirmed by siblings, we have an ultimate sympathy and empathy for her. The child, Sheila LaBar, deserved to be compassionately cared for and made safe, and it didn't happen. And also there was a distance between her and her mother, so there was no protectiveness there. But we then look at the crash where she had taken an overdose and believed that she had had some kind of near-death experience and was coming back to the earth with a new opportunity, which was to avenge these people who are harming children, and that delusion plays in again to a very serious head injury potentially that left her in a coma for a week, on top of the history of trauma culminating in a woman who had a rage within her for what had happened to her and a desire to see a man as either perfect or a paedophile. And nobody can be perfect, so there'll always be a paedophile. And that's how she defines these men. She gets with them for a period of time, they're okay, she likes them, lust is involved, they give her what she needs, and then she tests them and tests them and tests them and tests them, and ultimately she tells them, you are this, you are that, you are the other. And in the end, because of the violence, they admit what she wants to hear, even though it's untrue. So she is both the judge and the jury. She is ultimately God. She is being the avenging angel, albeit in a way that is completely unacceptable because these men are innocent. But if you look at how the emotional interplay exists, that NDE, that head injury, that childhood, that desire to feel special, because that plays into the ego as well where she is concerned, and to ultimately make a decision over somebody's life and death, that's very alluring to her, because there is nothing exceptional about this woman apart from the violence that she uses against men. And every time she kills a man, is she actually killing her father? Is she killing the person who caused her, as far as she's concerned, the initial wound that has blighted her life? Or is she just truly evil? Men would not necessarily even be afforded the analysis that I have just given, nor the analysis that I have read reports where others give. Or is it just a case, again, of looking at somebody like Sheila LaBar and thinking, well, she looked good when she was younger, therefore she must have been good, which is completely untrue. We get it. We think that if something is shiny and nice, it must be shiny and nice. It's ultimately why people die, because you trust people that you shouldn't. And in this case, I think that Sheila LaBar used the exterior to essentially hide her interior to a point where she managed to control and contain these men and then destroy them. So what I'm suggesting is that maybe it's because she's a woman that we've afforded her all these other potential explanations, where if she was a guy, we'd just say evil, we'd just say cold, calculating, manipulative, dangerous, violent, killer. It's maybe the disconcerting feeling which comes when a woman is a serial killer versus when a man is a serial killer, because it feels like the abandoning of everything that is female when individuals do what Sheila LaBarre did. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.